It is Saturday, January 24th, 2015. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch. With me in the AIR studio today is Lyle Troxell, a photographer, software engineer, and father.
Hello, Bonnie.
Hello, Lyle. And Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
Guten Morgen. Well, lots going on today, but first, on a somber note, I just want to dedicate the show today to an American institution that is going by the wayside. Ladies and gentlemen, SkyMall
has filed
for bankruptcy.
Now, all of us are familiar with this. If you've been on a plane, it's that magazine of stuff that's too cool to be true and also too horrible to buy. And it's a mix of wonderful horribleness, right?
Well, not necessarily horrible. Maybe you need an electric Tyrek.
Yeah, before the internet, like it was kind of like a sharper image,
yeah.
Right? It was like, wow, this is really neat. And, oh, it was really overpriced. But too late. You already bought it.
So, you know, they're selling things like, you know, a Darth Vader toaster or a paper towel holder that has USB ports. You know,
sure.
The important things in life.
The important things. The Internet of Things. They're trying to get it going.
And unfortunately, SkyMall LLC is seeking a court-supervised sale of all its assets. It's going bankrupt. That's news from Thursday. A little sad.
It's a little sad. However, its legacy will live on.
Yeah. After I got this story together, you showed me something I'd never seen before. Now, SkyMall, of course, is mall as in a place you shop, M-A-L-L.
In the sky. And it's how you keep yourself amused on the plane and feel like a jet setter.
But you know of another SkyMall, Bonnie?
I do. There is a comedy troupe out of the Bay Area called Casper Hauser, which has produced two SkyMall spoofs. And they spell it SkyMall, M-A-U-L. The first one is called Happy Crap You Can Buy From a Plane. And the second one, very cannily, I thought, is called Where America Gets His Stuff. And we'll have a link to Sky Mall, the fake one, an online version.
Things they sell on the Sky Mall is the bananaganizer.
Bananaganizer. You don't want your bananas to be disorganized.
So this is a rotate, like a Lazy Susan for bananas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something very useful for young parents, the everlasting diaper.
Yeah.
You just peel off a layer and keep the baby going. Starts off with a very big rump.
And one that might replace Don, who does an amazing show before us, medical test result fortune cookies.
Yeah.
So if you want to know your results before you get your tests, you just open the cookie.
And you get a cookie.
So
that's all not available for real on SkyMall, M-A-U-L. And you can
But SkyMall is going away. Now, the thing is, they're going to sell the assets. And, of course, the name is going to be an asset they'll sell. Most likely, some other company will take it over. Mm-hmm. It might just be a URL to redirect to some big shopping site that has crazy stuff like this as well. And pretty much anything you can get on SkyMall, of course, you can also get on Amazon or any of these other large
Pretty much, systems. Although we'll see if Amazon will carry the comfortable TV listening headband, for instance.
Have you ever bought anything on a plane besides booze?
No, just the booze.
Just the booze.
Just the booze. I know what I'm doing. that's a blend of something real and something fake we just talked about. And Lyle, Facebook is going to help us out now with what's real and what's fake. Do you want to tell us about that?
That's right. I was actually listening to Morning Edition this morning, and one of the stories they covered by Laura Seidel on NPR was that Facebook has a new feature. And Facebook's had this issue of fake news showing up, and then people post that fake story, and then post that fake story. And we've talked about this issue.
And people think it's real.
And the thing about Facebook is that you can give a thumbs up or a thumbs down on stuff, which denotes interest or lack of interest. Sometimes that thumbs up, that liking capability is not. I mean, you can't do a thumbs down. Excuse me. You can do a thumbs up or you ignore it. Mm-hmm. And it's not great when someone's having tragic news. You don't feel like pushing a thumbs up. What do you do with a story that's a fake news story? An example that they have on their blog post, the Facebook blog post talking about this, is a Serious News, but it's a company that produces fake news stories, basically.
That's very misleading already.
The title of this one is Scientists Demonstrate irrefutably the existence of Santa Claus. And there's like a picture of a man on a chalkboard writing it down.
Uh-huh.
Scientists have been very clear for a long time that they don't get into predictions of Santa Claus or not. It's not something scientists actually do. So this story is fake.
Yeah.
But people share it over and over again.
I like that you present, like, science has made a stand of not supporting the investigation of whether or not.
There are some things that science cannot address. So what happens, of course, is a story like this hits and people share it. Now, this one might be a case where pretty much any adult's going to know that it's a fake story.
Uh-huh.
But there's cases where it's the line is unclear.
Uh-huh.
And so they're adding a feature that allows you to basically, on a little carrot next to any post that shows up in your feed, you can rank them, you can rate them, you can tell
like
the system.
Like for realness?
Yeah, the for realness. And here's what's you,
should,
the for realness.
Should just the people?
How for real?
How for real is it? Well, that seems like it could run into all kinds of problems.
So in that checkbox that you can actually do, and I recommend if you're going to spend time on Facebook to go ahead and start curating your list, remove people you don't want to listen to from your feed. You don't have to. You can still be friends with them and not follow them.
Yeah.
But there are things like it's annoying. You can tag a story. What's wrong with this post? Help us understand what's happening. And it's annoying or distasteful. It's pornography, which is illegal on Facebook's site or against the rules. It goes against my views. It advocates violence or harm to a person or animal, which would be a no-no completely. And this new one is it's a false news story.
Well, I didn't realize there were all those different things to select already.
Well, some of these have been here, and this one's a new addition. I don't know how many of these are new.
Huh.
But the thing that's interesting about this to me is, do we want to spend more time curating the stuff on Facebook? Like, if you want to go up there and start doing that, what you're doing is you're empowering that network to be more powerful and more effective. The more time you spend there, the more money they're making off of your information. And that's just a decision you have to make on whether you want to use the service or not. Miles, I grabbed your attention on that one.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that sounds similar to, I don't know, an amusement park. You're going to Magic Mountain, the more people who go to Great America. Sorry, I'm Southern California.
Yeah, sure.
Going to Great America, and the more people who go to Great America and participate, and you get more information about who likes what types of games, and you refine them. You're enriching the people of Great America, but at the same time, that's where the community goes. That's where you go for your entertainment or your collection.
First of all, I dislike your metaphor completely, because the more people go to Great America, the less interesting, the less fun it's to be there. It gets too crowded. Facebook network service is not like that. But I get what you're saying in the sense that the more people enjoy experience, the more enriched it is. Mm-hmm. This is a competitive advantage type of feature, which is, you know, network advantage. The more people add to the network, the more value it is to everybody in the network. And that feature is what makes Facebook successful. But what I'm saying is, if you participate more in curation on their service, you make their service more valuable to them.
But
potentially to you as well.
Yeah, if you're curating it, you're making it nicer for everyone involved. You're saying this is hate speech versus I disagree with it. That is data that can be used to make it make someone else's experience better. That, oh, this is hate speech, I can skip that. But, oh, this is just something that's good fodder for discussion.
Yeah.
And specifically, we were talking about this is just straight up not true.
Yeah.
That's education for fellow viewers of Facebook.
Yes.
But it also strikes me that if anyone can say, oh, this isn't true, whether or not it is, then there could be a conflation between this, my views are counter to this view.
That is definitely concerning.
Versus this is straight up not true. For instance, vaccinations, right? There's been a story rattling around Facebook that there was an outbreak at Disneyland and now it's spread. And I don't know, because I haven't seen the story elsewhere. I'm kind of a person who willfully doesn't check out the news.
But you've definitely seen it on your Facebook feed.
I see it on Facebook, and I don't know whether it's real or fake. I kind of thought, well, maybe it's fake. I don't know. If I hear about it,
somewhere
else,
as this service comes along, theoretically, if it works well, you'll see in those stories that have been tagged by people that people have tagged them as fake. Now, that doesn't say that it's fake necessarily, but the sentence they're using is, many people on Facebook have reported this story contains false information.
Oh,
so that what gets added. Now, it's also possible that enough of that happens, the algorithms might pull out of your feed. But in general, I like that tacked on it,
that's
potentially
good.
It wouldn't get removed completely.
Now, the question to you, Miles, is that story real or fake about
the Disneyland one?
Vaccinations at Disneyland, or like people not being vaccinated at Disneyland and then there being like a measles outbreak?
It is unfortunately absolutely true.
Shoot.
And one thing that brings to mind is the Wikipedia idea, which is you have anyone can go and edit stuff, except there may be some contentious ones. And if you have credentials, if you have a degree in biochemistry, for example, and you're editing a topic that relates to biochemistry, then you are given
special rights.
Yeah, yeah. Special rights. I wonder if you you have stuff like this where it says fake, and then an epidemiologist shows up and goes, no, actually, that's true.
Well, so I'm curious.
Waited back.
Yeah, what I'm curious is that if one service like this company, Serious News, which is actually a fake news thing, every one of their stories gets a lot of tags of that nature, then that clearly becomes kind of a mark of all their posts. So you could see this being useful in a real news story like from a reputable magazine being posted and linked to directly. It would be unlikely to be removed as fake news because even if people marked it that way, it wouldn't. It's probably more real.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I would love
tell us about the problem in Disneyland.
Well, Disneyland. One of the things that's been an issue is someone showed up at Disneyland with a case of measles, not intentionally.
Sure.
Which is the case with a lot of infections, but measles is 90% infectious or more, and airborne. And
don't we have a vaccination for it that's like 90% effective?
Yeah, actually, 98%, I thought. It's pretty up there, 95%.
It's like condoms, though. They only work if you use them.
Well, not everyone can use them, which is unfortunate because I believe 6 of the hospitalized victims are infants that cannot get the vaccine because they're under 6 months old.
Oh.
Which is not to say that it's just those 6. It's just that there were, I believe, 22 people who were unvaccinated who got sick.
Okay, so I don't know the details of the story because as soon as I saw the headlines on Facebook, I thought it was fake.
The general thing is that people in this country have been not vaccinating their children for a few years, and it's becoming more and more popular to go, no, vaccines are scary and dangerous, and I don't want to do that. I want to put my kid through the trauma of having shots. And therefore, enough people now don't have the vaccinations that measles is coming back. Effectively. Mm-hmm. And so this is just a case where someone had measles, came to the population, a larger percentage of the population than normally actually doesn't have vaccinations, and it spread.
And the herd immunity wasn't enough this time.
Can you explain what herd immunity is, Miles?
I need to find a computer program, a simulation that does it. It was really wonderful. But it basically amounts to if you are immune to something and you know the 5 other people around you are immune to it as well, and one person comes in who is
susceptible
or has the disease, it's very unlikely that any of those other people are going to be infected.
Right.
If you have 100 people and one of them is not vaccinated and then another one of them has the infection, you have to get through this wall of vaccinated people are very unlikely to get the disease in order for you to get it.
Right. So the density of the population that could be affected, if it gets to a certain level, if it's a minimum level, the herd, the entire population, basically is not affected by this. Every once in a while, a case will emerge, but pretty much it's very unlikely because it won't spread effectively at all. Mm-hmm. But as you increase the potential people that could be infected, you lose that quality in the society. And this is what happened in Disneyland.
Right. And I will look for the simulation because I highly recommend anyone who is having trouble grasping like the mechanism of how it works. It allows you to tweak by dials
the algorithms or the program.
Here is the communicability of the disease. Here is the percentage of people who have a vaccination and percentage that don't. And then you just run the simulation. It does a random number generator. And you get to see like this tipping point for it where the high vaccination rate has like 3 cases and it stops.
Yeah.
And then the vaccination rate drops to about, say, 80% or 75%, which still seems pretty high. And suddenly a huge percentage of the population suddenly gets infected, including all people who are infected. And Bonnie just looked it up, and it's the herd immunity simulator.
And we'll have it at our website, geekspeak.org.
Probably like right away.
Yeah.
So specifically about the vaccinations, the reason people are and are not vaccinating is a very touchy subject. And that's one of those examples that this, you know, potential the problems of, like if the Facebook page about vaccinations is locked down, right? I'm sorry, the Twitter, Wikipedia page is locked down because it's so contentious. People have so many views on it. Mm. In general, the take that I have personally is that, I mean, I vaccinated my children and I highly recommend people do. And people I love did not vaccinate their children. And I don't, you know, I don't blame them for it or I'm not angry at them for it. But I'm hoping that most of the population will vaccinate because it's safer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, even like the flu, I think it's more, if you vaccinate, you know, yearly for the flu, you're less likely to die because of medical conditions than if you don't vaccinate for the flu. People die of the flu.
See, I'll take the bad guy side of this. I actually am angry when someone doesn't vaccinate on something like the measles.
I wouldn't say that's the bad guy. That's the self-righteous guy.
Yeah, because, well, I mean,
People are dying because of it.
15, 20 years ago. Well, so far, no fatalities I'm aware of. But 15, 20 years ago, measles was on its last legs. Like, it was...
We almost got it.
Yeah, almost got it. And there really were no domestic cases of measles showing up. It was someone who was coming in from out of the country and...
Where they didn't...
A
they
small
came from
outbreak was... Right. And it was stopped. And the thing is, I don't want to have... I don't want my daughter to have the vaccine, but she does. And it is possible to eradicate a disease. We've done so with smallpox.
Right.
And polio is on the edge. But if someone who is infected, for example, with polio shows up in the U.S., there are enough people who are unvaccinated that polio could come back.
Oh, God.
Or diphtheria. And yeah. These are things that I'm just like, I don't want
to. This is a gateway outbreak.
We don't have to take smallpox vaccines anymore. Like, no one, kids don't get them anymore because smallpox isn't around anymore because everyone vaccinated back in the 60s and 70s.
It's pretty awesome.
50s, 60s, and 70s. Mm. And so I am angry that people don't vaccinate because that means that it's prolonging this argument. It's prolonging the amount that these deadly diseases are around to hurt us.
It's interesting, though. As a parent...
So if that makes me self-righteous, so be it.
Okay. But the other aspect of this, of course, that you look at your child, your infant child, and you go, if only my child doesn't get vaccinated, everything will be fine. If enough people don't have their kids vaccinated, we have a problem. So I want to make a decision as from a society perspective, but also as a parent perspective. And that's the dichotomy there, right? Mm-hmm. You have to make a decision that's based off of the greater good for the society. And in longevity, the greater choice for your child. But in the short term, a painful choice. Well, I mean, I understand that the instinct. I'm just – let's move on. Yeah.
Okay. So tough times. Lots to talk about coming up here on Geek Speak. Another great show on KUSP is the 7th Avenue Project. And on the next 7th Avenue Project, tweezing, shaving, waxing, corrosive chemicals, radiation, electrolysis, lasers, and now the prospect of genetic engineering. Human beings have gone to extraordinary and sometimes suicidal lengths to get rid of unwanted body hair. Why the follicular fear and loathing? Why is a hairless body to die for? Host Robert Pauly talks to historian Rebecca Herzig about her new book, Plucked. A History of Hair Removal.
Oh,
that's going to be so
that's
interesting.
That's going to be great. Oh,
Robert Pauly does it again. That's the next 7th Avenue Project. That's tomorrow at noon on KUSP. We highly recommend that show.
It's also available as a podcast. You can search for 7th Avenue Project anywhere, and I think it's 7thavenueproject.com with a 7, not the number 7.
Right.
Which didn't used to be a legal domain name early on in the case. But
now we have it. And if that's too confusing, you can look them up also through KUSP.org.
Yes.
Suddenly I want some tweezers.
You're pretty hairy lately, dude.
He's got
a full beard
going
on. I'm doing this whole little thin stash. What do you think, Bonnie? Not so much?
A little chin spinach, I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Still, but, so you frame it nicely with between the mustache, the chin spinach, and then the chops coming right
Go
down.
Go on. No, let's not.
Anyway, facial hair, you guys. On Geek Speak, that's the show you're listening to now on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. A couple of web extras for you, Lyle. Let's go first with yours.
How about watching 100 robots dance, baby, dance.
Oh, this
all
is
in
unison.
Good. It's a little creepy.
Yeah.
A little cool. Gotta say, I love it.
A synchronized dance of 100 kind of Chucky-sized robots.
Yes, that's the thing about them is that they look all cute and miniature and small because they're on top of tabletops.
Yeah.
But in actuality, they're the same size as Chucky, the doll that kills people.
Right.
And that's kind of what my mind goes to when I see synchronized robots. The thing is that the robot can actually move quite well. It's joints everything. It's pretty neat.
Pretty smooth. Nice kind of like movements.
And at the same time, I know that the brain inside that thing is not so great. Not as good as my dog, for example.
Yeah.
And so it feels like, yeah, that's neat. That synchronized thing it can do.
But we could all topple them like dominoes.
But and also like it's not going to be able to like do anything practical in a non-controlled environment. You know,
so it's not time to salute our robot overlords just yet.
That's right.
I welcome our Chucky lookalike dance baby dance robot overlords.
Nice. And thanks to Greg Merkley, our Canadian correspondent, for bringing us that web extra. You'll see it at our website, geekspeak.org. Another one, pretty Northern Lights captured in high definition. Really gorgeous, you guys. I've never seen them live.
Is this video?
The closest I get. It's a good video.
Yeah. Okay, good.
A couple of different angles on it.
Chandler is busily working on putting this up at geekspeak.org right now.
Yeah, so you'll be able to find that at geekspeak.org also. Miles, tell us about Apple exploits that Google is publishing. You actually work at Google.
Yes, I work at Google, so full disclaimer there. Google has been dropping information about the about various security exploits and bugs in Microsoft products, which people were kind of going like, ah, look, they're doing it to Microsoft. And then they published three about Apple, and suddenly people went, wait, you can't do that to Apple.
Why not?
Well, people were referring to it as zero day. And I just wanted to come out and actually clear the air a little bit
what's a zero day?
Means that you are publishing exploit code and there are people who are breaking into people's computers, and that's the first you hear of the exploit.
So there's a lot of security exploits that we know about and we start patching. The company that's dealing with it patches it and then says there's a release for this, and then they announce that the problem emerges. And so anybody that they want quickly just updates their system.
Okay.
But a zero day is, hey, you're being infected. There's a problem. There's no solution. And then you just wait for a long time until a solution comes around.
It's just information that you're being screwed at the moment.
Well, basically, it's releasing the pattern a little too late in the game. What you got to do is hold off on releasing the knowledge so that people have time to fix it.
Well, those are for researchers. I mean, zero day usually refers to someone.
An exploit inactivity.
Yeah, someone who's a bad actor wanted to.
Okay.
So are these exploits in Apple's code that Google has announced zero day?
On the contrary, a zero day means that the same day that you announce it is the same day that the vendor knows about knows about it. Google let Apple know about them 90 days prior.
And Apple just hasn't done the elite squad on it.
And Apple didn't have the patch up
for 90 days.
And same thing happened with Microsoft.
What kind of vulnerability are we talking about, Miles, on this Apple thing? What kind of vulnerability are we talking about?
This one is relatively...
this is on a Macintosh computer, not on an iOS device.
Right. All three are considered lower level in that you have to already have access to the machine in order to do these things. At the same time, if you combine them with other exploits that get you onto the system and then perform what's called a privilege escalation.
Escalation of privileges, yeah.
So that you're, instead of being a normal user, you become the root user or super user. Then they suddenly take on a whole new tact.
One is the it's a null pointer dereference in the accelerometer code in the Intel chip. So another one's regarding the Bluetooth. Has to do with memory corruption due to a problem with the Bluetooth I/O protocol. So these are kind of low core level things.
You already have to have access to.
But of course, this kind of thing can be taken advantage of. Like, for example, I mean, I could get into how you potentially get a problem with them.
I've got questions.
Yeah.
So Google said to Apple, hey, Apple, we see some problems like 90 days prior. Mm-hmm. And Apple went, okay, that's nice. I got some stuff under my fingernails. I'm working on some other things. They didn't really do anything about the exploits that Google pointed out to them. Is that
right? I don't know that that's overstating it. That's putting Apple in too poor a light, in my opinion.
But no, the truth is that Project Zero, which is a project that's run by Google, I think other people are involved, security firms are involved in it. So it's a project that aims at getting rid of these zero-day exploit problems.
Okay.
By saying, yeah, we vetted this, and company that has a problem, you need to deal with this. So when you get a post from them, it's you can trust that you've got a problem.
Okay.
Right? So it's a good umbrella for this kind of problem.
So then it's true that after 90 days, no fix for it had yet emerged.
That's right.
They may have been working on it very actively.
It's really hard to fix them.
Okay.
There's lots of reasons why they might not have done it.
So why did Google then go, well, I don't see anything, so I'm just going to go ahead and publish these for everybody?
It has been a long-standing issue with the computer industry for researchers to say, hey, here's a security problem. And sometimes those security problems are severe.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
someone over the network can then get access to a machine and root it.
Which is
companies
a real
like problem. Yeah, companies like Microsoft or just any vendor. I don't want to actually narrow it down to Microsoft because they've been doing a relatively good job with security of late.
Yeah,
have basically said, well, there are no exploits for it. It seems kind of like theoretical code, and we have these other features that we want to get out. These new features that we want to prioritize for it, so it'll just sit there. And so you would hear about these bugs that researchers had would
known
tell
about.
A company about. Like 2 or 3 years ahead of time, and then the actual bug gets released,
right.
And they were saying, hey, they've known about this for 3 years, and they haven't even worked on the patch yet.
This is the real issue with these things. These vulnerabilities makes the system vulnerable.
Right?
There's a lot of them, but it makes them really vulnerable. And if you say, hey, company like Apple or Microsoft, you have a vulnerability, and the Microsoft decides they're not going to deal with it, if you're really responsible in some sense, you wouldn't tell anybody else. You just wait and wait and wait. The problem is that if you figured out, and you're a good guy, the bad guy figured it out too, potentially, and is taking advantage of it. So the issue is at hand.
It becomes an ethical quandary.
Right. When do you do it?
Do I keep my trap shut, or do I speak up so that we can do something
about
this?
We had another example of this last month with a serious vulnerability that Microsoft was told about. And after 90 days, they hadn't fixed it, so it got released.
Yeah.
And 2 days later was their Patch Tuesday, which is a monthly thing that or every 2 weeks that Microsoft does, where they release patches. And on those days, that's when they were doing it. So there was a two-day window of a problem, and Microsoft was upset. They didn't just wait two extra days.
I thought it was 2 weeks, actually.
Oh, maybe it was. But it was a cycle regarding their...
It was a cycle.
But it's Microsoft's business practice to release on Patch Tuesday. That's a decision they're making. It's not something that every vendor, everybody in this in community has to bow down to. So it's a tricky situation. I personally think that you should set a date and a range and do it, because that means everybody that has vulnerabilities will be better about solving them to the 90 days of notification, which I think is crucial.
Well,
90 days is too long.
Well, something to note about, I don't know if 90 days is too long, because
you only have to
go through a QA process.
You're only saying that because you're a software engineer. It is too long, but I don't know if it could be faster.
But as a point of reference, you have the Internet Engineering Task Force, the IETF. These are folks that say, like, hey, this is what the TCP protocol is about, and here's how the...
That's a network protocol.
Right.
Defines the internet.
And you have outfits like CERT, which is... I've forgotten what the acronym stands for, but they're a security outfit. They post vulnerabilities. IETF, their policy is once someone figures out that there's a vulnerability, you have 30 days before they make it public. CERT, it's 45 days. So it's not...
And Google's Project Zero is 90 days.
Right. And people have said, well, what if Microsoft and Apple start doing this to Google? Well,
fine. That would be great. Actually,
I would actually say Google already encourages this. There's a bug bounty program. If you report a bug and it's not been seen before, you get paid.
Did you say bug bunny?
Bug bounty.
Yeah.
Bug bounty.
But you do get money, and with that extra money, if you find a vulnerability that Google doesn't know about, you report it, and you're the one that's told about it, they will give you money, which you can then go buy bunnies, if you'd like. So there you go.
I see. So it all comes
the
bounties, full circle.
Yeah, always,
45 days.
If you
told Google, and 45 days later, Google hadn't patched it, and you released the exploit anyway, Google will still pay you.
Yeah,
like that's
okay. So it sounds like you see this as sort of like some healthy kind of raising up of the whole industry.
I work for Google, but I don't speak for Google. I don't want to have that be in question there.
Okay.
But at the same time, my personal belief is very strongly that we need more of this, not less.
Okay. So though Apple may be annoyed, you say it benefits everyone.
Right. And I think it's inflammatory for online articles to refer to it as a 0 day, because it's not what it is.
Right. It's a 90 day.
Okay.
It's a 90 day.
It's a 90 day. By the way, I believe it's a 90 day. I think you'll find it's a 90 day.
I'm sorry. I believe it was a 90 day. I was told that it was going to be a 0 day, but actually it's a 90 day.
I believe that was not my 0 day. All right. Let's move on to the social media sphere. What's happening?
Unlike the Facebook stories earlier.
Yeah. Let's move back, I guess, to the social media sphere. Twitter, Instagram, what's going on?
Yeah, okay, let's give you some context.
Yeah.
Instagram is a photo sharing site. They got very popular by having an iOS app that made pictures look old and busted, giving a kind of a throwback to stylized pictures.
Nostalgia.
Insta-stalgia. And the quality of them are really cool. The app kind of created this culture of making pretty pictures of the day. Mm-hmm. And I follow people that just do really cool pictures of trees or, I don't know, whatever, right?
Yeah.
So that's Instagram. That's a photo sharing service.
Okay.
Facebook owns it now. They bought it a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, there were some problems with the way photos showed up in Twitter from Instagram. It used to be that if you posted a link to an Instagram photo, the photo itself would display in your Twitter feed.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, Instagram turned that off. They basically said, that's not the way it's going to work anymore. Don't take our stuff. And the reason for that, of course, is that if you could, through Instagram, see the photos, through Twitter, see the photos, you'd never actually visit Instagram, which would demean the system of Instagram.
Right.
So
okay.
They turned that off, and what's happened is Instagram has gotten very popular. In fact, Instagram has more active users right now than Twitter, which is shocking, actually. Yeah. And now there's a bit of a debate about this and what it actually means. Miles, have you heard much of the story about the size of the different groups?
I have not.
Okay. I just thought it was kind of interesting that the amount of, you know, which size is bigger and all that. So Instagram has grown, has 300 million monthly users. So every month, 300 million people use it. Mm-hmm. And Twitter has the official count of 284 million.
Okay.
Now, some of these are going to be bots and things.
Right. There was that story a while back of all the celebrities. It turns out, you know, many of them had so many fake users that they went from having like a million people to eight people.
Following them. I don't think it's that small, but exactly. There's definitely some fakes. So so Twitter kind of has bit back a little bit lately.
Yeah.
They've been posting to kind of more well-known people, that journalists, people that post on Twitter. When they post a Instagram link. So, but you can still share stuff on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
An Instagram link will actually allow a person to click on it, and then they move from Twitter over to Instagram, right?
Okay.
So there's a movement direction that direction.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen opposite direction, because when you don't post on Instagram, you don't put other links, you put photos,
mm-hmm.
and those photos will be up there. So the causation of this is that Twitter loses people to Instagram over time.
Okay.
So Instagram is now, whenever somebody posts that's kind of famous or followed well, a link of Instagram on Twitter, they show a little dialogue that says, hey, you know, if you post on Facebook or on Twitter directly, your photograph, it'll show up in everybody's feed. And they kind of show what it would look like if you moved away from Instagram over to Twitter.
Okay, so Twitter is courting the famous in hopes of reversing this unfortunate trend.
Yep. It's kind of
okay.
Cool.
Interesting. Little industry back and forth there.
One more translation bit, and this is brought to you by Gawker? No, Gizmodo.
Gizmodo.
Gizmodo recently noticed that tweets are being translated for you on the fly, which is kind of cool.
Mm.
So if you follow someone in a language that's not your primary language, the tweet will actually show up translated into your primary language, and there'll be a little flag to the right to see the original. And it kind of notes that it's problematic or that it's been translated.
Yeah.
Translation is not perfect. It's actually transformation. I wouldn't call it translation. It's not, you know, translation really is complicated. But
yeah.
They're using the Bing Translate service, which is Microsoft's Translate service, which is kind of interesting. And I thought it was kind of neat. And then when looking into Twitter's translation stuff, I saw that they actually have a really cool fact on how you can help translate the Twitter website into your own native language. So they have support a lot of languages, but they have a whole support system for allowing people in other languages that have two languages to translate.
Yeah.
Is that only on the web version of Twitter, or because I haven't seen that on the Twitter app?
The translation feature?
Yeah.
It just emerged on Thursday, so maybe you just haven't seen it yet. Do you follow some people that are non-English?
Mm-hmm.
I'm also curious, like, how does it determine what language is set? You know, what is the language? Because 140 characters, if half the words are technology words that are kind of ubiquitously between languages, it might be difficult to detect what language it is.
They may have their choice of which language they do, because the non-English speaker that I follow is putting up a simplified Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they might not cover it.
Which
that's
I
true.
Don't speak at all. But
me neither. Not
they
even
point
a little.
To some really interesting articles that you can't read.
You can't read.
Well, no. That,
well, so that's interesting. Twitter's like, hey, Facebook-owned Instagram, quit taking our users.
A little fighting.
But hey, Facebook-owned Bing, come help us with
Bing,
our
I think, is owned by Microsoft.
Oh, it's not owned by Facebook.
I don't think so.
I thought I just heard you say that. Okay.
I'm sorry. I probably did say that.
Yeah. All right.
I didn't mean it.
Interesting. Well, so that's a little bit like you go to the Green Burrito and there's an A&W root beer in there too. They're sort of like combining forces.
Yeah.
That's a poor analogy.
Yeah.
Let's just.
I mean, the thing is, they needed a translation service, and Twitter was going to choose basically Google Translate,
yeah.
Which would drive traffic and metrics to Google, and mm-hmm. it's something you have to potentially pay for,
mm-hmm.
or Bing. And Microsoft is trying to get more market share, and so getting Bing as your search engine or as your translator is really cheap compared to other services.
Okay, so that's a good get.
Didn't Yahoo recently switch to, or didn't, what was it?
Somebody.
Firefox went over to
Bing or to Yahoo.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
It went to Yahoo. Yahoo uses Bing because Yahoo doesn't do search anymore.
Nice.
So it's all very tertiary. Well, speaking of trying to get things, we're looking for some tweets. We've got Twitter account. It's at @KUSPGeeks. That's all one word, at @KUSPGeeks. And if you have questions or comments for us, go ahead and send us a tweet at @KUSPGeeks. We'll respond to tweets during the show today if we get some, or we'll collect them up and address them next week. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. And today we're talking about all kinds of things. Next up, holographic glasses with Google Glass going down. Maybe some other kind of eyewear will take hold, Miles.
Point of order, Google Glass is not going down. Google Glass is moving to an actual system, and we'll see one in 2015.
That's my
prediction. So I don't like predicting stuff like this because I'm always wrong, but I assure you this year, no, I don't really assure you, the Google Glass team is still working on it, and there's going to be a new feature. Yeah, I think 2015 we'll see one.
Okay.
That's the current general buzz.
I've heard different...
Everybody comes up and is like, oh, too bad about Google Glass. So I'm like, what? No, it used to be development, now it's going to be product. That's my take on it. I could be completely wrong.
You could be completely. So we don't really know if they're actively still working on it or if they went, well, that's over.
Pretty sure they're still actively
working on it. We had to replace Lyle's pair four times. Just forget it. Maybe they gave up. We don't
know. But Google Glass is not augmented reality.
Okay, but this is augmented reality because it's holographic glasses from Microsoft.
Yes, and something that's right out of Blender tutorials, actually. Blender being similar to Maya and other
3D rendering
editing and 3D rendering software,
mm-hmm.
where you're able to mark off certain points like the edge of a table, like
in a photograph,
in a video as well, frames of a video
is
a common thing.
Okay,
and then it uses those points of reference to be able to figure out where the light source is, and then render whatever 3D object is to.
They're doing it. Cues and rendering something in the moment.
It's the Roger Rabbit effect, but for 3D.
Wow.
And doing it in real time and doing it in a set of goggles.
Right.
That's what Microsoft has done.
Ooh, that's pretty fancy times.
Now, this stuff is called augmented reality because you see through the goggle, you see the room you're in, but new things are in the room that aren't actually in the room. And it's a really cool effect. Now, Phoenix Taos, who's been on Geek Speak a couple times now, he does this research. He does this research himself. He uses iPads and iPhones, which have cameras. And so you can hold the device in your hand, and he overlays stuff by locking to the imagery in the screen and doing cool things like that.
Yeah.
This video that Microsoft has would be really cool if they could do that. But you can't do that.
This is what it would be? That's what the video is? Working on it?
It'll be like this, but you'll notice in the video it's perfectly done. It's done probably with Maya or something like that on the video by somebody doing it by hand.
And the Minecraft stuff, they chose very specifically because they are such simple graphics that they're not doing anything more complex.
The issue is not the graphics. The graphic rendering is no problem. You can do that till the cows come home. We just put more graphics cards and wear a backpack. But the actual locking of the geographic location and your visual surrounding with
time,
an overlay image that perfectly matches isn't possible. It's just, I've done a lot of this type of stuff. You need to have a lot of power to be able to get your micro movements of your head. I mean, if you move your head a millimeter in one direction or your eyeballs a millimeter in one direction, the shift of the area behind, you know, at the wall level, 10 feet away from you is feet, right? And therefore, you're going to have to re-render this stuff at extremely fast speeds to keep up with the tracking in the environment of the room.
Okay.
So it's really tricky to do this stuff.
So let's be clear.
They will
then
have it, of course, but you don't move your head quickly.
So this is something that Microsoft has announced that they're working on, not something that they've announced they now have available.
Is that right, Miles?
What's the real story here?
I thought they had a demo, but I may be wrong.
I guess the point is that it's probably going to... Is it available now, Chandler, or just a demo? All right, demo.
We don't know. But anyway, we're going to link to the Ars Technica article.
Yeah.
So that we can all research it together.
And the point is that this is the future of, like, overlaying stuff is something we're going to have. It's cool. And it just, they're overselling it
right
now.
Well, to be clear, though, whereas Google Glass is, it has its own processor on there. And it can connect up to your phone to do stuff. But it's doing the rendering itself. It's figuring out what to put up there. And it has a battery pack to keep it
that
going
gets
for
warm.
A while that you use out and about in the world.
Yes.
This is meant to be used indoors. It's meant to be used within your home, and it may have images being streamed from another device.
Yes.
So it may just be the input and output source and not the thing that actually crunches the numbers, which is what I think will
So to be clear on terms, virtual reality is you go into another environment, you don't have access to our universe.
Right.
You have a private universe.
That's Oculus Rift.
Oculus Rift. These goggles and other systems like it are augmented. reality. You're still in this reality, but you get augmented.
Okay.
Google Glass is none of those things. Google Glass is an information display screen. There's no overlaying. It's just there. It's a screen that you
see.
It's
just on your head also.
It's like a dashboard in your car.
That's the only thing that's in common. That's it's also on your head.
So they're all three different technologies.
Okay. And Chandler reports that they have, in fact, come up with a live demonstration so you can see the state of the technology right now.
I want to see it.
Yeah. And we'll have that at geekspeak.org. Next up, Windows 10, free for some.
Hmm.
But not for the Surface RT crowd.
Surface RT is the Surface, like, laptop? Or not laptop, but, like, yeah, it's like a laptop with a touch screen, right?
Yeah.
So you want to say some more about that, Miles?
Well, Windows 10, it was announced. Free! If you have Windows 7 or Windows 7 or Windows 8, Windows 8.1.
That's pretty big. That's new for Microsoft. They've never done this before.
Right.
Really, the updates you have to pay for?
Yeah.
If you're switching from one totally different system to another.
Okay. Right. They were the last holdout, really, because OS 10's been doing that for years.
Right.
Linux has never been charged for, really.
But why wouldn't they make it available on the thing they're touting the most?
Probably because it can't run on it.
that may be the issue. This isn't to say that they aren't going to have some features from it. For example, some of the new features that may come with Windows 10, they'll port over. But it's just not going to go whole hog over there, because if you code for an older system, for older hardware, then you're limiting your newer hardware by the abilities of that older hardware.
That's right.
And so Windows 10 really is moving more toward what can the current generation of hardware do. Let's target that. And those individual pieces that seem to work okay, we'll send those back to as patches of Windows 8 to the Surface RT.
Okay.
So Microsoft, of course, it's also Windows 10. There is no Windows 9. They skipped a version, which is annoying.
That's weird.
Just from the pneumatic.
Why don't they just call this one 9?
They had a very good reason for it.
Windows 95 and then they hit?
Yes.
I think that's Vegas. I didn't hear that.
They used to have Windows 95 and Windows 98. Those both start with a 9.
Yeah.
That's the reason they didn't choose a 9?
Because when people still have on websites, they're looking for user agent strings to say, like, what operating system is coming in, what web browser is coming in.
Okay.
And many of them were very lazy. And so they said, oh, hey, if it says the string Windows 9 and... because they're assuming there's going to be 5 or 8 after that, then it's going to be this experience, it's going to do this thing and be this software. And otherwise, we're going to, if we see a Windows X, it's going to be Windows XP. If we see
it was
a Windows 7.
A nod to our lazy research.
Web backwards compatibility.
It was very much that they tried it out and they saw that a whole bunch of sites were breaking because of that. So,
yeah, okay, I can see that.
All right. Okay.
Dumb reason, but okay. But in any case, it doesn't matter. It's just a number. Who cares?
Yeah,
so for you guys,
but
if
Windows
you have
10,
a less exciting device.
So Windows 10 is the newer version. It's not out yet. It's an alpha. You can actually try it out. Over 100,000 people are currently using it and working with it. So it's a pretty stable, ready-to-go kind of thing, which is exciting. It's got some neat new features. Yes, it's going to have the start bar, unlike what 7 first removed that and then had to put it back in.
No, 7 had it there. 8 removed it.
8 removed it. And then
like 8.1, they put it back in.
Right. So in any case.
So should I get it from my device here?
It's a really interesting question. I was thinking about the story. Like Windows, Microsoft's developing a lot of time into it. They're kind of the underdog now, right?
Yeah.
It used to be that they were not the underdog, but now they're the underdog. And so the question is, could we see potentially a stable enough operating system from Microsoft such that we'll pull people away from Macintosh into that environment? It is possible. The technology changes a lot, and I could see the potential. So I was thinking, well, what would it take for me to move to a Windows operating system? And unfortunately, I would need like a Unix kernel. So that's not going to happen, most likely. Microsoft's not going to do that because I don't care about that.
Why do you need a Unix kernel?
Well, a Linux Unix kernel. I want to have command line interface with all the tools I know.
Because you can. Because you know.
I want to have get and set.
Well, that's different than the kernel. That just
no,
means you
not
want
the kernel. I'm sorry.
You want your user land utilities.
I might want user land utilities.
The
now, if someone took
themselves.
And made a Unix compatible user land utility system for Microsoft, which might actually exist,
like Cygwin,
is it that good?
No. Well, I mean, like it does.
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
So you can do a whole bunch of stuff with the user interface that you use with your mouse and your keyboard on your computer. Tons of things.
Yeah.
Open applications, all that.
Okay.
There's actually, on a Macintosh environment and a Linux or Unix derivative environment, there's a command line tool, the first terminal. The terminal technology that's there, the language of that environment, the shell,
right.
Is something that Miles learned when he was in college, and it's the same. So there's this long history of the same kind of underlying create directories, move create passwords, all the stuff you can do. You can run the entire operating system from that command line. Macintosh has that same interaction as Unix does.
More or less.
Or more or less. They're different. Yeah. But as a developer, I'm in that environment a lot because it makes a lot of sense to run server-level stuff and
so
compiling
it,
things.
It is as a developer that you really want that capability.
Kind of crucial.
Okay. Got it.
I don't know about crucial. I'm just saying.
My question was, here I am, dope. I don't develop a thing.
Yeah.
I'm just a user. Should I update this Lenovo ThinkPad with Windows 10?
Is it currently running 7 or 8?
It's running 7, I think.
I wouldn't be the first to do it.
Okay. Why?
I'd stay with 7. If you were already on 8, yeah, I'd say switch out to 8 because 8's horrible.
8
but
7's
an okay operating system as long as you're doing all the patches possible. Uh-huh. You're going to get rid of that and go to a Mac pretty soon, right? Anyway.
Well, and I'm not getting rid of this. This is my work computer also.
Oh, perfect.
This goes to the old experience that advice that I give to anyone with regard to a new operating system. Wait for the first service pack.
Yeah. And that will be a while. And additionally, I wish I had waited on Macintosh 10.10, right? It still has problems. So, you know, you always kind of want to wait. But the other thing is, you're comfortable in a Windows environment. You know what you're doing on that computer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would you switch away from it to Mac? So, you probably do want to upgrade at some point to Microsoft.
Let's be clear 10. About my situation, because I'm sure everyone's very interested. My work computer is going to stay a Windows machine.
Ah.
In addition, I'm getting a personal laptop, which will be a Mac.
Okay.
So
you have to live in both worlds.
Yes.
That'll be fun.
I'm slightly ambidextrous.
Luckily now, the keyboard dimples still are in the same spot on both keyboards. Used to be that Mac had a shifted keyboard dimple, which would drive you insane.
What's a keyboard dimple?
On your keyboard, put your fingers on the keys.
Oh, where the dip is on each key?
Well, yeah, there's a little dot or dip. There's a little marker that represents the F and the J.
Oh, which I don't pay any attention to those anyway. Because
it's for a touch
I'm a
typer,
lazy
so you know
touch
where,
typer.
Oh, okay.
I have to look at the keyboard anyway.
So you know where home is.
Yeah. So it's a home.
So they don't have it on the F and the J on the.
Do now. They used to not. Mac used to have a different positioning. I think it was on the D and the K, and your hands would go down, and you'd shift them out, and then you'd type garbage. And I used to do both operating systems, and that was the biggest concern. Also, the control keys are different.
First world problems.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about something else. Let's get into just like general philosophy of AI and things. And stuff.
All right. So you're going to ask me for the three laws story?
The three laws story. Now, Miles, there's a history of this three laws that has to do with robots and Isaac Asimov.
Yes. So Isaac Asimov wrote years ago the three laws of robotics, and you probably all know.
If you saw iRobot, you heard them.
Mm-hmm. You've heard these laws. They're attributed to Asimov. Asimov did make them. You might not know that they're Asimov's laws because they're actually just the three laws of robotics. And these are a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey the orders given to human beings except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And then the third law is a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law.
So, I mean, is Boston Dynamics actively using these laws when they come up with their freaky, powerful robots?
They don't have enough artificial intelligence for that.
So we're not there yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
so,
I would say that
is it a given that we will be incorporating these laws once the robots are capable of
grasping them? As iRobot story shows, it has a flaw.
Okay.
And that is, what is allowing a human to come to harm? Human beings' own personal decision-making is causing harm, the robot could potentially use that to control the humans.
Okay.
So. I was actually going to say, Asimov has a series of robot books, and each one documents multiple flaws.
But that's not actually what I wanted to talk about.
Right,
I want to talk about
a format.
Yeah. I want to talk about Doctorow's three laws. I've talked about Cory Doctorow before. He's a he's a part of BoingBoing.net, mm-hmm. one of the writers there, mm-hmm. and he also has a strong belief about copyright and he has really interesting ideas on how that works.
Is he associated?
He's a journalist.
He is also with the EFF, or does he just like
those guys a bunch? I think he used to be with the EFF, I recall. But yeah, he supports them.
Okay,
he's not a member of that anymore.
Yeah.
So Doctorow has three laws relating to digital rights management and copyright.
Oh, okay.
And so I thought they were kind of interesting. I thought it might bring up a good conversation. Law one. Anytime someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't give you the key, it's not there for your benefit.
Mm.
The general concept of digital rights, to do digital rights, for allowing digital rights to run on your computer, you basically have to lock down your computer and give control to somebody else.
That's like the ransom exploit is about that.
It's like if you watch video on the internet on your computer, you're participating in that. It's okay. It's a core feature of digital rights management. Okay. If you have a Kindle, you have this problem. There's locks on the Kindle that don't allow you to do what you want with the text. That's for Amazon's benefit, not for yours. Even though you own the Kindle, they have a lock on it.
Okay.
And we have laws in Congress that force you not to be able to break those rules.
Okay, so that's law number one.
Yeah. Law number two, fame won't make you rich, but you have a hard time getting sales if no one has heard of you. This is a general concept of, do you give away your music or your intellectual stuff that you create for free? Mm. If you get enough of a following, you might be able to make money on it. If you become obscure, you'll never make money.
Okay.
So the general concept he has is, if you're a creator, create and give. And hopefully at some point you'll find out how to make money from that if you get successful enough. So it's an interesting idea. Mm-hmm. Fame won't make you rich, but you'll have a hard time getting sales if no one's heard of you. And the last one is, information doesn't want to be free.
That's actually an interesting dichotomy between those two.
Yeah. You can read his book on the same title, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, to get more of an idea of it.
Okay.
But I'm constantly impressed with Doctorow's talking about copyright and DRM, and lots of the thoughts I have and bring addressed to the show actually come from him, so I thought I'd give him a little credit on some of those thoughts.
Okay, so you can read more about that. We'll have a link to a little bit more from Cory Doctorow's laws at thecreativepen.com. You'll find that at our website, geekspeak.org, where you can find about this or any episode of Geek Speak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So please reuse our stuff any way you like, but do tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. You can contact us. Go to geekspeak.org to learn out more. Email us at geeks@geekspeak.org and contact us on Twitter. We're at KUSP Geeks. Today's theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. Thanks to our intern Chandler. And thank you for being here for our January 24th, 2015 episode of Geek Speak.